And welcoming you, dear listeners, to after, well, immediately after that particular track there by The Empire of the Sun with the song Music on the Radio. And primarily what seems to be not such a chilly or cold morning session, as, you know, in comparison to previous editions, specifically where, you know, we find ourselves here on a Sunday morning early. Obviously starting off the day for many of ourselves. Okay, I'm starting off the day for many of you, and primarily some of you waking up early at that stage to tuning in, as well as also being, you know, present during that particular scenario. Now, if you've woken up, I do hope that you've got a hot cup of something in your palm, ultimately just relaxing. And as we get this particular morning session of my Sunday morning take here, going on your number one talk radio station. Now, this morning's discussion, it has, I don't want to say comparative, but I am comparing in a scenario, you know, a period primarily that has somewhat become topical in Namibia. And it is a discussion primarily of whether or not we are going to achieve the particular national goals that we've set ourselves up, in terms of our, as our targets to achieve in the country. Now, the reason why I say it's primarily this particular kind of discussion is I am taking a look specifically at Italy in this morning's discussion, primarily because there was a period that Italy had experienced known as the years of lead. Now, the years of lead, obviously, as you can immediately, you know, infer, is probably with these bullets, right? Yeah, yes. They had, what was called a tumultuous period from 1960, or immediately just after the reconstruction, after the Second World War, but starting from 1960, up and until 1980-something, just to be sure, there's a specific time frame that they've listed. Yeah, from 1969 up to 1987, primarily, this was the period. Yes, it's a decent 20-ish years. It cites a specific time frame in terms of political direction, trying to understand what politics to follow and who is to be the clearer of the sort of like political guiding lights in a country. And you might probably see the same particular thing currently in Namibia. Not the violence. We are not there. We Namibians, we are something else. And yeah, we find ourselves specifically also being lucky in terms of the time frame where Namibia got its independence. We are slightly lucky in terms of the hyperconnectedness. Now, I'm referring back to the discussion on Friday on the home run, whereby you heard the opportunity of the South African Mr. Ivor Isikovits, who explained primarily from a survey report across Africa that they've done, his organization, and the perspectives of the young people. Primarily that, and this report also cites it, that they want to see developments and, you know, delivery and performance on these political promises that were made in elections to happen now. And this is from the youth, the Africa youth discussion. Now, this is something similar primarily also in Namibia. There's a specific reason why I also brought up the abstinence or the complete ignoring of last year's elections, local authority elections, by the youth, because they didn't know these people. You could clearly see from showing up, was there any campaigning? We don't know. You hear from the few media reports, but in terms of turnout, the turnout was not the same as with the particular presidential elections. Okay, that's sort of like our basis, doing a little bit of a comparison We don't understand specifically the importance that local councillors have to play in our development agendas, but we believe that a president and a political party will deliver on the grassroots level. Okay. That is our disconnect. That's Namibia's disconnect. The reason why I'm looking at the years of lead of Italy is primarily on the 1st of August. Is it the 1st of August? 1980. Let me just be sure. On the 2nd of August, which is specifically today. On the 2nd of August, 1980, one of the worst chapters in Italy's modern day history took place. And this primarily was the Bologna train station bombing. Now, the Bologna Centrale, which is the train station's name, the Bologna Centrale was struck by a suitcase bomb that was planted close to certain parts of the infrastructure that allowed the roof of the train station. And if you know how big European train stations are, they're literally terminals of transportation. And a terminal is a pretty massive sprawling building. It collapsed the roof, which fell on a specific infrastructure, meaning one of the trains was damaged by the collapsing roof, as well as also many people who were standing on the platforms of the train station waiting for their respective connecting trains to pay. And this happened in late summer in Italy. And some of the people obviously were trying to still go on holiday during that last particular time frame there in Italy. A lot of confusion ensued after the event of the bombing. Why do I say a lot of confusion? Because it helps to explain one of the particular sort of like discussions in terms of the political direction that Italy was trying to understand. Now, let me cite this. I'm not saying, nor am I citing, that similar events will come up, probably in Namibia. I'm not saying that. I'm also not saying specifically that many of our political parties ultimately are, you know, problematic. I'm not saying that as well. Each one has a particular constitutional right, specifically in a political sphere, to exercise the politics that they wish to. It's just as long as the politics is in line with the constitution. That's all we have to understand. Now, the particular bombing of the Bologna Centrale culminated in 85 people losing their lives and more than 200 being injured. This is also then as blame started shifting to the political elements within the country. And remember, this is 1980 or 1981. No, 1980. This is 1980. Back then, society was not as connected as society is today by something known as the internet and the various particular internet products or internet companies. No, back then, people had to rely on what information comes directly from the police and what information comes directly from, the public prosecutor's office in that respective country, and what are the snippets of information flying about. People were literally in the dark. Just for those of you that were young back in 1980, I'm sorry for citing the youngness, but for those of you that, you know, were young back in 1980, you could imagine the level of information that you were exposed to. You just had to think back. You could imagine the lack of, you know, having clarity on many particular things. There are actually similar events in Namibia specifically also about lack of clarity and so on. Now, it then speeds up into a scenario whereby an Italian neo-fascist group was being convicted of murder and other particular charges that were connected to the bombing. Even though, and remember, this comes from an encyclopedia platform itself. It says the following sentence. This is the best sentence. Although the full truth and identification of those behind the bombing may never be known. Now, it is funny. It is funny, specifically looking at this kind of a statement, primarily in a respectable encyclopedic platform that espouses so much knowledge, collects so much knowledge, updates so much knowledge, that we technically sit with a question mark. Now, the best thing in many scenarios, even in a journalistic sense, and these were discussions even before I joined, fully transitioned into the information dissemination aspect of the media landscape in Namibia, is I asked, who was a former professional, editor about discussions and certain particular, aspects of journalistic reporting, whether it be in Namibia or around the world, as to why in some cases that they would leave a question mark in their stories or in their articles. Yes, in some cases, I'm also slightly guilty in certain cases, because you could immediately see that some particular developments are partial, they're not fully. And in some cases, it's also a discussion of what is the crux, what is the gist of this particular specific development or chapter of this overall project. When question marks appear specifically in journalistic writing and in the writing part of things, you get a sense primarily that, maybe not all the information is available yet, if you're the reader, or you just understand, okay, so this is a current update. Okay, here's the next update of this particular development. Or if it's something like a crime-related or a civil court case-related development, then you immediately also know as a reader, okay, so the developments, so this is still something in development. Obviously, taking into consideration in a Namibian context when it comes to, like, for example, like the court case writings, it is difficult because in many cases, a lot of these court cases take years to finish in Namibia. They take years to finish. We just have to cite one of Namibia's most prominent court case, which is still the ongoing fish rot development. It's been, is it now 7 years that those guys have been going through that's pre-trial and bail hearings. So yeah, it's been 7 years now. You obviously do get a sense that, because you don't even know whether or not Namibians are talking about it anymore. You really don't know. But so many things have developed or happened between 2020 up to now. Now, I'm sketching to you a picture in Namibia. A picture about how the information gets spread, how it flows. We obviously have pluralism in terms of information dissemination. There's a healthy radio broadcasting environment in this country. The print media is not so healthy. We have a partial pluralistic approach to TV broadcasting. This is primarily that we've got 3 TV stations in Namibia, 2 privately owned, 1 national broad, which is the other one obviously being publicly owned, or should I say government owned, because there's a clear definition in terms of that entity's particular understanding on it, whether or not it's a public entity or whether it's a state-owned entity. And public broadcaster is not the same as a state broadcaster, because primarily that entity is fully state. It fully support state, and the state goes and asks them to primarily do much of the broadcasting work. So that's how you see primarily the information around the country, how it gets disseminated and spread. And obviously then there are the social media platforms. And it's also developments primarily based upon what I've been, you know, not pulling my hair out about, but suffering in silent frustration about, specifically that we as Namibians, we've got to embrace websites, the understanding of websites. A Facebook account is not a website. The Facebook platform is a website, and it is, and you are feeding that website, and that webs, and no, that, and yeah, that website, and that website is ultimately gaining its notoriety from your work. But if you had your own website, I mean, I always like looking back at these memes that are on the internet about people who say, do you guys remember when you could open up a website just like that? You could own your own website and you could just fill it with whatever you wanted to fill it with. And this all happened in the 90s and the early 2000s. And then you started seeing this particular formalization of a space, a digital platform or digital space primarily, whereby people or organizations basically became the larger particular operators on the internet, which makes things also slightly tricky. Now, think about the particular developments about how what I just described to you about information and how you get your information and how you interact with the information and the decisions that you make regarding the information that you have or are exposed to. And then you take, and then you compare it to the line that I just shared with you, the line whereby no clarity could be provided from the investigations of 1982, August 1980, with regards to that bombing. Now, the particulars specifically of what happened on the 2nd of August 1980, which was a Saturday morning at about 25 minutes past 10 in the morning, the air-conditioned Centrale station waiting room was filled with people seeking to travel on holiday away from the summer heat. Now, in this confined space, a suitcase time bomb packed with high-quality TNT collapsed the ceiling on everyone inside. It destroyed most of the main station building and wrecked the Ancona to Chiasso express train at Platform 1. Now, hundreds lay dead and injured in the rubble, and Italy was shaken to its particular core. Now, from that start, the official investigations were mired in disinformation. Only specifically looking back could you see probable partial truth that could disentangle itself from the major conspiracy theories that were running rampant at the time. Now, with sentences like that, you get an understanding that the investigators themselves faced also possible interferences by unwanted entities, or, you know, entities that are not in line specifically with police or with investigations or any of the particular sort regarding, being given the particular sort of like time of day or allowance to conduct such particular work, or be involved in such particular level of work. The reason being is that the explanation behind the event of the explosion or the bombing, it took place during a long period of political violence from both the far left and the far right organizations in Italy that were known as the Years of Lead. Now, though it was first thought that a boiler might have been the reason for the explanation. Thought, which is very interesting, because if you also look at primarily, for example, what I explained to you just now in terms of where the explosion took place, what the explosion aimed to damage, and what that damage aimed to do, This meant that primarily the explosion investigators had to look for a cause. A cause that probably might not speak to it being accidental, because probably to them it looked like an accident. Remember, I explained to you, it was an explosive device placed close to certain parts of the infrastructure. So it wasn't placed close to where it would directly harm people, but rather bring down something. Another dimension, obviously, that also speaks out from this is, where does the boiler explanation come from? Or the boiler reason? The search for the evidence soon revealed that it was a bomb. Because you had to prove then that if your theory of a boiler, not prove the boiler was there, prove that it was a boiler that was faulty. Now, within weeks, arrest warrants were issued for 28 members of two militant neo-fascist organizations. The first trial did not begin until 1987, and the following year, two of the convicted or arrested interested parties, Francesca Mambro and Valerio Fioravanti, and two others were convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. Those four and a further four were convicted of being members of an armed gang. They were convicted of being part of an armed gang. But I'll get to some more information. On appeal, the Mambro and Fioravanti were acquitted of murder in 1990. But in a new trial that began in 1993, they were again convicted and sentenced to life in prison. A verdict that was upheld up until 1995. Numerous others also went through a similar process of trials and retrials with varying outcomes on such charges as forming armed gangs and interfering with the investigation. But taking you back also still to 1987, another gentleman by the name of Licio Gelli and others were convicted of planting false leads, including a second bomb, in inverted commas, that was found in Bologna Station in 1981, to implicate a different group of right-wing terrorists. Now, Gelli was the leader of a sort of like an underground organization known as the Propaganda Due. Its initials was P2, which was a clandestine right-wing breakaway Masonic lodge that was believed to be complicit in the bombing plot. And if you went and looked up this Licio Gelli, this gentleman, he was also a businessman and a convicted terrorist under Italian law, primarily as he was also part of a major right-wing organization, because he was known as being a fascist volunteer in his youth, meaning he had roots to the era of Mussolini. He had roots to it. As well as also that he was chiefly known for his role in the Banco Ambrosiano scandal and the Bologna massacre, because it was revealed in 1981 as being the venerable master of this particular organization, Propaganda Due. Now, what I just explained to you highlights also how many particular political entities were interfering with providing false information to authorities. Now, remember, in the 1980s, anything before 1990, or anything before 2000 primarily, any kind of development, any major talking points before 2000 stood the greatest risk of interference, specifically from political actors in any country, anywhere in the world. Let me say that again. Any major development in your economy, which can be even cited as a small topic, any major development in the country stood the risk of primarily, various political actors having a say and claiming to have a say specifically on these kinds of developments. Now, just to cite to you the sort of like rounding out developments of this particular bombing event on 2 August, was that in 1990, declassified documents began to emerge suggesting that NATO and the American CIA organization were intimately involved with a parallel organization in Italy. And this was part of NATO's anti-communist European network, known in Italy as Gladio. This organization has also been suspected of involvement with the Bologna train station bombing. Now, Fioravanti's unconditional release from prison in 2009, despite his refusal to admit guilt, lent credence to the belief that there was government involvement in the act of terrorism. Now, over the years, various new investigations into the bombing have been opened and new trials have also taken place. For example, in 2022, a Paolo Bellini, a member of a different right-wing organization at that time, than that of most of the earlier defendants, was convicted of having been the person who left the suitcase in the waiting room. Now, it was known as Europe's most deadliest terrorist attack until the Madrid train bombings that took place in 2004. And the Madrid train bombings, I partially remember them because the time frame in terms of when it took place was a little bit mired, because 2003 was when the Iraq war began. 2002 is when the Iraq war began. 2001 is when the Afghanistan invasion began. And much of that period between 2001 to 2010, or 2010, okay, before 2007, basically, that 5, 6, 7 years up to 2007 was mired specifically in the war on terror, the war in Iraq, and the war in Afghanistan. That's all I remember specifically. But I do remember that the Madrid train bombings happened. Now, let's look into specifically the period under which this event took place. Now, I explained to you a little bit earlier that the years of lead, which was technically when political violence in Italy was at its height, which was a 20-ish year period from 1969 to 1987, cited specifically that there was fragility in the political direction for a country like Italy. Now, if you ask, Dwight, are you comparing potentially by saying that Namibia also has political fragility? There, I technically would say no, because in the Namibian context, if you look at political fragility, it's not the overall ecosystem per se. It is primarily the direction that Namibia is potentially gravitating towards. The direction being that it seems like Namibia is slowly but surely becoming a one-party state. And I said this multiple times. It is unhealthy to have, and I mean it. I really mean it. It's unhealthy for one party to continuously just win. But hey, there's nothing you can do if the whole contest is based upon popularity. And unfortunately, if all the other political leaders cannot convince everybody to basically cast their vote for them. So, in a nutshell, that's Namibia. The dimension that we needed to look at is primarily what was taking place back then in the 80s in comparison to today, right now. In comparison to today, right now, in Namibia, you potentially can establish a communist party. You can. You can establish a socialist party. You can. Because primarily, you know, well, I don't know if you could establish a new party. Let's just be sure about that. But you can establish either of the two. Because primarily, we now obviously have to look at things in terms of information dissemination and the developments around the world. And primarily, what politics has become. You know, political violence is not as heavy anymore, even though just 2 years, 3 years in that direction, just after COVID immediately, we had, you know, major demonstrations, but they were predominantly very friendly. They were very friendly, well organized. Yeah, some people, you know, experienced demonstrations for the first time, but we didn't have major fallouts from it. And when you look at these demonstrations, they are based upon legitimate national issues. Legitimate national issues. One was the SGB, the shut it all down SGBV demonstrations of 2020. Flowing into 2021, you had the genocide and the joint declaration demonstration. That was the one that was co-organized by three political parties, or was it four political parties at the time? And these were obviously major national talking points that still are unresolved in the country, specifically about how women and children, you know, suffer violence in this country versus how, and including how Namibia is dealing with this particular historical unresolved subject matter in its history. When we look at these particular things, you can basically see, okay, so we don't have severe sort of like political discontent. I'll use the word discontent because it speaks towards whether or not the average person on the street cares about the political stance or has a political affiliation or believes that, you know, politics should be the guiding light for Namibia's future, which we've placed it there as Namibians. Obviously, that's why we engage in the elections. But during the times of the years of lead, it was criminal in some cases of Europe to be part of a communist party or to be a sympathizer. It was criminal. Europe is greatly socialist. Obviously to the unhappiness of a country like the United States, who technically hates everything socialist and everything communist, it was disappointing for them. It was disappointing for the British, obviously, also. But the Europeans chart their own course for their own destinies. It's one of the reasons why I like their logic, which is the logic which much of us Africans also follow. You know, you go for what makes sense for all of us. No, really. That's why in many cases you see that there is some sort of a, it's sort of like a correlation in terms of Africa's destiny is primarily also how Africa then looks at Europe. And then Europe knows that Africa is part of Europe's destiny. And primarily how Europe then tries to help Africa achieve Europe's destiny through achieving Africa's destiny. This is the newer element that's taking place, obviously. Now, in Europe, you can be a right-wing party and you can have a communist party now they use left and right wing in many scenarios. If you come to Namibia, we, much of that particular application of understanding of left and right wing would also be present in Namibia. They would be specifically Namibia's whole election system is very conservative, and primarily it is slightly, it's slightly not so liberal. Now, I don't want to say right wing, because Namibia insulates itself by saying you need to prove that you have a Namibian ID, you need to prove place of residence, and you need to prove that you are of voting age. Just three requirements. That's all we have. But currently right now, if you go to the United States, in the US, from what I've heard is that specifically for national elections in the US, each of the US states have unique election legislation. Okay, not each, because I saw a presentation of a senator or congressperson where he cited that there's a few states that have unique legislation of how they conduct presidential or whatever elections. Their elections legislation. They've got elections legislation. And then there is the rest of these US states that whereby an elections becomes a federal, you know, it's conducted on a federal level. Meaning that these states don't have specific elections legislation in terms of how an election should be conducted in that U.S. state. Now, for something in a U.S. context, which is now being championed in specifically by Donald Trump and his administration, they want to bring in voter IDs, meaning that you've got to prove that you are an American citizen before you participate in the elections, which is something we do in Namibia. It's a run-of-the-mill standard practice in Namibia. The ECN has this voter verification process. They tell you, please go to these sites. Please indicate you register for a new voter's card, or you update your voter status, and you get issued with a new card, and voila, you continue from there. Yet, we've got to understand specifically that themes back before 1990, before our independence, were serious themes of primarily what you could not exercise as your right. Labor unions, which Namibia has an abundance of, are seen specifically in the United States as a communist era participatory aspect. The Americans, who are the birthplace of labor unions, believe that labor unions today technically are vehicles for communism. They still believe it. Their politicians still use these labels. It's not Dwight's words. I am just summarizing to you what I've observed. Now, when we look at a particular period in terms of what I'm now describing to you as how you need to see the current political framework or the climate in Namibia, it is lukewarm. It is technically cooled down. It is technically cooled down. The biggest talking points that we have to see, which are technically determinants, meaning they're going to determine whether or not Vision 2030 is going to be materialized or will materialize. Look, the year will still come. It'll still happen. It'll just be a question of whether or not the goals that Namibia has set itself, whether or not Namibia will meet those goals or reach those goals or deliver on those goals. So what are these goals? And I'm excluding the SDGs explicitly right now. What are these goals? These goals are, for example, the green hydrogen developments, the majority of NTP6's talking points, the oil and gas, because I still want to know. People are saying, how the actions of people in the Namibian economy, because, like I said, that, which I now call a very funny engagement, the oil and gas conference, is going to come up in the now or in this month, August. And I'll tell you again, I'm believing my own particular sort of like internal conspiracy theory right now. People are talking about oil and gas as if the thing has been being sold, is being sold currently. The question in my mind today, now, after 2022, when the first announcements came through, after I interviewed, I had that brief interview with Mr. Malunga, when was it the Shell or the Total Energies discoveries were announced, and I, you know, I had to stand in for the early morning scoop for that session, and I asked him, listen, is this legit? And he said yes. In that phone call, that in that interview. So Namibia has targets, and these targets will determine whether or not we actually see something happening. Because today, 2026, the 2nd of August, this Sunday morning, the whole country is primarily asking, is just waiting. Because the biggest talking point that has come up and that has technically sort of like stifled any conversation has been the 2023 census. The census confirms we've got a population bulge. How do we deal with a population bulge? The population bulge feeds into the discussion Helmut and I had on Friday in the home run, specifically looking at what African youth are citing. And when you step forward from that talking point, there is Africa's discontent. There would be Namibia's discontent. Delivery on prosperity. Now, the years of lead of Italy was a period of socio-political unrest. Let me emphasize it again. Socio-political unrest. That began in the late 1960s and it continued through to the mid-1980s, during which both far-left and far-right extremist groups carried out acts of political sabotage, kidnappings, bombings, and assassinations. Now, it is estimated that between 1969 to 1987, about 400 people were killed and over 1,200 were injured in attacks and that were attributed to much of these groups. The name for this period, the Years of Lead, which in Italian is known as Anni di Piombo, is thought to derive from the lead bullets that were used in many attacks. Alternatively, some scholars have also suggested that in 1981, the German film Die Blairen or Blairne Zeit, meaning the Leaden Time, which has a plot involving terrorism and was released in the US as Marianne and Julia, may have attributed to the use of the term being applied to Italy. Now, it emerged this time frame, this years of lead time frame, it emerged from the profound social and economic transformations that followed after World War II, which saw Italy experience an economic miracle and shift from being a largely agricultural society to an increasingly urban and industrialized one. I'll put my bookmark in right there. That is literally what Namibia is going to undergo. That is literally what will happen to Namibia. Much of Namibia's policies, I've cited the pro-poor elements specifically of Namibia's particular predominant is a pro-poor one, which does cite also the involvement, obviously, of labor unions in achieving, socio-economic goals, as well as also looking at various aspects of rural development as well. But NDP6, NDP6 and its view, its overarching theme, is modernization. Modernization fuels rural to urban migration. Rural to urban migration, for all you local authorities out there, means you've got to step up your game. Stepping up your game primarily means getting your act together and specifically delivering on services, availing land for new developments in your localities. Yes, you can still play the politics, specifically in the council chambers. However, work needs to be done. Now, when you go and look at modernization, a factory is not built in the rural areas. A factory is built close to where services are. A rural area does not have a council. It's an urban settlement that has a political council who makes decisions about what particular economic priorities to pursue in an urban setting. Now, we also realize, primarily, that Namibia definitely has limited financing. Or let me say that the Namibian government has limited financing to achieve much of its particular goals. That's why budgeting takes place. Now, Namibia will definitely, when that first barrel of oil starts flowing, and Dwight's conspiracy theory is proven wrong, when that first barrel of oil starts flowing, we will definitely see major change. It is a question just of how that change will manifest. Because remember, oil is mining. It's mining. And Namibia is setting a course, specifically through its policies and its other particular developments, of achieving its industrialization, its modernization, through mining. Not through agriculture. Through mining. But agriculture is also being set up specifically to advance part of Namibia's industrialization. So that we don't have a large dependency. Well, so we don't have the lopsidedness in terms of earnings and salaries and wages in this country, predominantly reflecting that agriculture still employs the most people, but that it still pays the weakest or the least. Now, as we've reached the midway point of this morning's discussion, dear listeners, we're really going to take a short musical break. After the musical break, we're going to come back and we're going to head into the rest of the second half of this morning's session here on My Sunday Morning Take. Now we come back there from the sounds of INXS with the song Never Tear Us Apart. Before that was Diodato with the song Latin Flute. And before that it was Bebe and Sean Lee with the song Year of the Funky. Now, just where we left off primarily that in terms of just doing a little bit of not an actual comparison, but seeing similarities. Now, during this particular period of transformation and reconstruction for Italy right after the Second World War and the miracle that it obviously was experiencing, the economic miracle, obviously the major shift was that they had, they were moving from a largely agricultural society to an increasingly urban and industrialized one. This transition also prompted large-scale migration from rural areas to major cities, where overcrowding and inadequate urban planning intensified social tensions. Now, at the same time, citizens put pressure on the government to provide modern housing, education, and labor rights. And with these needs that were still mostly unmet at the time, younger generations in particular grew increasingly dissatisfied with the political and social order. Huh, I wonder where we've heard that before. But coming back to Friday's discussion once again, with an African twist, obviously, associated to it. Now, by 1968, factory workers and students began organizing themselves into protest groups to advocate for their needs and their rights. The following year, initially, peaceful protests became violent during an economic downturn known as the Hot Autumn, in which factory workers went on strike and staged mass demonstrations in protest of low pay and poor working conditions. Both far-left and far-right extremist groups then turned to terrorism in an effort to destabilize the American state. The Italian state. Don't ask me, guys. I don't know where the American part came from, but the Italian state. Though, for different reasons, left-wing militants sought revolutionary change, while right-wing groups, using what they called a strategy of tension, hoped to provoke support for authoritarian rule. Far-left groups generally employed more selective tactics, such as kidnapping, assassinations, sabotage, and kneecapping, which was very brutal, whereas far-right groups favored indiscriminate high-casualty bombings and incidents. Now, citing the primary organizations during this particular period who were responsible for much of this particular unrest and upheaval in Italy, one of them, or the lead one, as it technically is identified here, was known as the Red Brigade, or the Red Brigades, or its Italian version, the Brigate Rosse, and the front line, known as the Prima Linea, were among the most prominent far-left terrorist organizations. The Red Brigade's assassinations and attacks left nearly 50 people dead between 1974 and 1988, including a former prime minister, Aldo Moro, who was kidnapped and held for 55 days before being murdered, and 78 that were wounded, while the front line was responsible for 18 deaths and 25 injuries. Now, on the far right, another organization by the name of New Order, Ordine Nuovo, and another organization by the name of the Armed Revolutionary Nuclei, whose Italian name was the Nuclei Armati Rivoluzionari, which was an offshoot of the New Order, were among the most active neo-fascist terrorist organizations. The New Order was linked to the 12 December 1969 bombing in the National Bank of Agriculture headquarters building located in Milan's Piazza Fontana, as well as several other attacks. The explosion, which took the lives of 17 people and wounded 88 others, is often referenced as the start of the years of lead. The NAR, which was the sort of like the abbreviation for the Armed Revolutionary Nuclei, began carrying out attacks later during the years of lead. Most notable was the bombing of Bologna's Central Railway Station on 2 August 1980. Now, this is interesting. I'll stop there. This is interesting as the previous resource that we cited, that we started from for our discussion, which was based on the 2 August 1980 bombing of the train station, highlighted specifically that knowing the actual truth and the actual people who were responsible would probably never be known. But here we're citing in another resource specifically that it is the NA, that it is one of the particular far-right organizations, or far-right terrorist organizations in Italy. Now, it was considered the deadliest act of terrorism during the years of lead because the explosion killed 85 people and injured more than 200. Five members of the NAR were convicted of this crime, and it is widely believed that the Propaganda Due, the other particular secret organization, led by a fascist businessman, Licio Gelli, was also involved in the bombing. Now, in addition to the Piazza Fontana and the Bologna railway station bombings, New Order also planted a bomb in a trash receptacle amid a crowd gathered at an anti-fascist protest in Brescia's Piazza della Loggia on 28 May 1974. The explosion killed 8 people and injured more than 100 others. On 4 August of that same year, 1974, a bomb equipped with a timer was placed on an Italicus Express railway car filled with vacationing travelers. It exploded while the train was passing through a 10-mile-long tunnel near San Benedetto, Val di Sombro, killing 12 people and injuring 48. Now, another organization, which was actually a successor organization to New Order, known as Black Order, later claimed responsibility for the attack. Now, during the years of lead, that period, gradually came to an end in the late 1980s after the introduction of new laws in 1982 that offered reduced sentences to terrorists who cooperated with authorities or agreed to formally disassociate themselves from political violence. Now, at the same time, legislation then also provided leniency to pentiti. Pentiti is penitent terrorists who shared information with the authorities. So, you know, sort of like a compromise discussion that took place there. Now, the combined effect of these counterterrorism measures helped weaken and dismantle militant networks in Italy. But the political landscape also began shifting as well. The far left and the far right groups lost popular support, and internal divisions weakened their organizations. Italian citizens then also began repudiating political violence, viewing terrorism as morally unjustifiable and also strategically ineffective. And by the early 1990s, political sabotage, bombings and assassinations had largely stopped. Now, to emphasize again, currently, right now, I don't see Namibia going through a similar particular period. Even though Namibia's formative years in the 90s was a tumultuous one, to be exact. Tumultuous in the sense that specifically that you saw, well, okay, in the 90s, when was I made to start read newspapers? I think that was 95. 96. Yeah, but they're about 95, 96, 97. The information was scant, should I rather say. And the information was also very limiting in what was shared back then. In understanding specifically, if you look back, you know, in history, there's a lot of developments that happened in the 90s specifically, that in many cases we didn't get to know much about on. And I'm talking about, that particular time frame or period of the particular national discussion and national discourse. Obviously, I was not in Windhoek in 1995 up to 1997. No, actually up to 1998. And when you look back in terms of trying to understand, okay, so what are the major developments? The major developments probably were just some of the immediate things that you would be paying attention on. Obviously also understanding that you are also in a different age range at that stage. I was most probably 14, 15 then. And yeah, if you're a 14, 15 year old teenage boy, your attention span is somewhere else. You are focusing on other things. Now, many of the particular scenarios were obviously, as mentioned, remnants towards the Cold War period, that obviously happened. And as I said, at the start of this discussion, this particular period of Italy took place in a particular time frame, where the Cold War was ongoing. The Cold War obviously ended by 1990. We obviously find ourselves in a new kind of a Cold War today. a Cold War that isn't one based upon ideologies even, because you don't even know, or you can't clearly say what, you know, what is the value system that in many cases, various proponents of the new multilateral order is championing. Now, when I say things, when I say that, but like that sentence, and I said in that order, you look to, for example, the green hydrogen development in Namibia, which aims to bring in a new fuel source, a new energy source for the world, but primarily for Europe, and then you could see this cascading into Africa. And then you see the remnants of, I call it the remnants, because you can see that oil is unsustainable. You can see that the global oil trade is an unsustainable mechanism, primarily because of this conflict taking place, primarily because of what the Minister of Industries, Mines and Energy said back on Friday. And there is just no way that Namibia technically can still look at the global oil supply and go like, you know what? This is potentially something that we love. This is an ecosystem we love. An ecosystem where you get attacked for your oil. You get into war for your oil. You get into war because you're trying to achieve whatever particular industrial goals or national development, energy development goals as a country. Not that I'm saying I'm in support of Iran, but that's technically Iran's stance. And the American and Israeli stance is just purely illegal. This means specifically that wars based on resources are still the main theme, which have been the main theme since time immemorial. The resources discussion is one that's becoming more and more prominent, more and more violent as well, more and more polarizing. Now, we've got to understand ourselves as Namibia. Since we've got so much of these particular resources, where are we going to go in our own future, as well as also in some of the other particular developments that are happening in and around the world? I greatly believe Namibia has a potential specifically for becoming a boat manufacturer or shipping manufacturing. Because if we just need a few things to fall into place. But then the downside on top of that has been also the great disparity in terms of the skilled labor that we can produce. And skilled labor, guys, we have to acknowledge, it does not include the university graduates or the universities. It includes just the vocational training institutions in this country. At what level those vocational training institutions are actually training and thus graduating people from? And where do these people then, you know, adequately find employment? Because Commerce Region technically doesn't have a mining facility. Technically. And much of the mining takes place around Commerce Region, in other regions predominantly. So we sit with another particular question of, okay, decentralization is our next particular aim. Not to decentralize in a scenario that is, you know, just random and so, but rather working on a basis of allowing formats of partially controlled and supervised development and growth associated, obviously, to that it is in line with much of our goals, and that we see the particular deliverables being achieved. The deliverables are obviously contained within NDP6, as we all well know. The biggest problem we've got to deal with is the modernization discussion. Guys, when I realized specifically by going through NDP6, and this is after I had read parts of the Guide to the Namibian Economy book, the one that I bought in 2024, where the book contains that Namibia has a problem in diversifying its economy, and Namibia has a problem in achieving its modernization goals. And NDP6 comes out, and NDP6 shouts clearly, modernization front and center. We have a big problem in terms of how modernization will be achieved. Because modernization, in many cases, dear listeners, means that you've got to scale this across all local authorities, all towns of this country. All of these towns have to play pivotal roles in delivering not just services, but on the necessary growth that Namibia wants to see. But it's also a question, because it's a particular hypothesis that I've been formulating. I've just been trying to get the necessary guests to interview on that discussion, because it is slightly in a more advanced discussion than what I wish to achieve, because it needs an academic to help me sort of like break apart that discussion. The discussion on whether or not we want growth or do we want decent living, which is a discussion about, and it's a discussion that I have grown impatient with as well, because look, economists are important, and economists have helped us as Namibians understand where Namibia wishes to be, but we also then have to look at sociologists. Sociologists and anthropologists help define what do Namibians want? Meaning, way of life. A discussion on way of life. A discussion on way of life then identifies a discussion on, is NDP6 matched up with possibly the goals that Namibia want, or that Namibians want? Or were these goals just made in terms of thinking about what's thematic, what's topical, what's the in thing, like a trend, because politicians love the trends as well. Not to say that, I'm not saying that our president loves trends. I don't know. But on the scenario of topical and what's trendy, it seems like it was, you know, and that is my suspicion of politicians in Namibia, developing a trend or following a trend or trying to cultivate a trend of something. And you're like, why are you cultivating this? So it's a scenario that we've got to look into, that we've obviously been assessing across the country. Whichever particular plane of the Namibian society you find yourself from. But it's also been one of mixed bag reactions and mixed bags, a mixed bag of mixed bags, because in some cases the mixed bags are also sort of like mystery bags, because you don't know what you're going to put your hand onto when you stick your hand into that bag. It's literally like the lucky packets that I only bought once in my life, and I was unhappy with the gift, the lucky gift that I got as a kid, and I was like, nah, never again. At least I want to see what's in the thing before I buy a lucky packet again. So we'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners, and we're going to come back right after this, heading into what is to be the last quarter of this morning's session here in your number one talk radio station. And this is Eagle FM, and you're here listening to My Sunday Morning Take.
once had a friend, and we had a home, till they asked me to turn back. Sometimes life is just like that. And there in the city, overlooking the sea, I found peace but can't go back. Isn't it so sad? How long the darkest nights, it all can be. Thank you.
break the bank, stash your cash with WB. Buy 2 kg packs of Tasty Rice for $69.99. A 1 kg box of Jungle Oats for $37.99. A 2-liter Oros for only $36.99 with Smart Buy. And 2 2-liter bottles of Stay Soft for just $89.99. See more month-end deals at furmanbrock.com. We care. Stash your cash.
Coming back there from the sound specifically of Santana with the song Oye Como Va, and before that it was from the Future Islands band with the song Corner of My Eye. Now, many countries, obviously, just, you know, just in our sort of like last 12 minutes specifically in terms of looking at this broader discussion of periods of discontent, as they would be called in some cases, or periods of turmoil, whichever one you want to go for. Many countries around the world have had similar scenarios. Some a little bit later than others, some a little bit earlier than others, but they've all experienced this. During industrial upheavals of a country specifically, you will see heightened rural to urban migration. You will see this greatly. Namibia is already experiencing it. We are no stranger to this activity, and this activity does provide a kind of a bonus, but it does lead to a kind of a negative, because you need to, one of the first particular things you need to solve is housing, or affordable housing, or access to housing, and whether or not this housing primarily is achieved through the regular scenarios. Another dimension, obviously, that also then starts popping up is a dimension of whether or not, you know, things are sustainable, as they currently are. And when I say speak about sustainability, looking at some of the particular, let's for example say some of the particular aspects in terms of nation building. Okay, no. Not nation building. Wrong phrase. Let me just say national development. Because if you had to look at like the thing that I love to complain about, and I love complaining about it because it actually speaks to this modernization scope of Namibia, is a lot of our towns that look like they're stuck in 1990. And people wonder why we have informal settlements. Well, because those local councils, those councils of those towns are not thinking ahead. They don't possibly know what the national development strategy is, and they probably don't care because they're probably not delivering on some of those particular things. You can't leave the burden of deciding Namibia's particular advancement just on Windhoek and Swakop and Walvis Bay. You can't. Many of these particular towns across the country have been stuck and have been comfortable with being stuck in 30 years in the past. They've been stuck. Now, when you cite this particular reason, this particular discussion, in some cases, I've seen it, people, you know, think I'm bringing up something novel and something new. No, it's just pay attention to your surroundings. Look at what's happening around you, in your communities, in your towns, in your local authorities. I don't want Namibia to experience ever anything like this, like the years of lead. No. But there have been political actors who've tried to instigate similar particular kinds of things. I'll say it again. There have been a few or a couple of political actors trying to instigate something similar. Now, you don't know if the ultimate cause is whether or not they will gain some sort of a, you know, improved setting or improved position at the ballot box in elections, or whether or not, you know, they are trying to be active currently as we are. Namibia is still going to see a lot of developments happen. Namibia will still experience a lot of these developments in future. Obviously that war in the Middle East is not doing us any favor. It's not doing favors to any country around the world, but it's a dimension in terms of where we've got to understand, we as Namibians, we as the everyday people, what developments are actually going to occur or come from, as we advance specifically on these particular talking points that I've just cited. These talking points are, okay, we understand the modernization component. We understand the national development strategies. We understand some of the particular needs that persist. It doesn't matter what presidency you look at, certain needs persist throughout, cascading from one president to another. The question is there going to be an end to this particular cascading exercise? And is there going to be an end specifically in terms of, you know, properly addressing some of these needs? Now, unfortunately, if I had more time, that does bring us up to the end for this morning session of my Sunday Morning Take here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And we step into some more music, and primarily after that, we'll be saying our goodbyes here for this Sunday Morning Session.
I get up time and time again, time and time again, time and time again. When I'm on my back looking at the stars, everything up in the air, and the same old ground keeps pulling me down. Gravity gets heavy. When I lose my grip, roll up a cigarette, smoke goes back into my face. on. Someone's gotta walk on it. And the words don't sound the same to everyone. Someone's gonna write about it. And I fall in love like Niagara Falls. Drown before I learn to swim. And there's no life vest when you're out of your depth. Trying to keep yourself afloat. Gonna need a bigger boat. Wipe my face, I tie my laces, say my prayers, I dust myself off. I get up.
fishing on your windowsill. Take a chance like a woman dreamers game. Find another way. You don't have to dream it all. Just live a day. Don't say a prayer for me now. Save it till the morning after. No, don't say a prayer for me now. Save it till the morning.
Of love.
Back there from those sounds, specifically from Empire of the Sun. And just to let you know, dear listeners, this is the end of this morning session of my Sunday morning take. And let's see each other again, same time, same place next Sunday morning. Alternatively, you can catch me through the course of the week on The Home Run with Helmut, and specifically where we are joined a little bit later on by David during the course of the programming. On that note, dear listeners, enjoy the rest of your morning in our company, and we'll see each other again, same time, same place.